And secondly, the virtue, the transcendental virtue of uprightness. And this is often rendered as morality. But as I observed the other week, I generally prefer to avoid this term, even though I do use it upon occasion. The term morality, unfortunately, has all sorts of wrong connotations for people today. Morality or uprightness in the Buddhist sense is really what we call skillful action. That is to say, action expressive of skillful mental states, or mental states free from craving, aversion, and ignorance. And there are various traditional patterns of skillful behavior. For instance, there's the 5 precepts, the 10 precepts, and the 64 precepts of the Bodhisattva himself. And these precepts, these sets of precepts, are not just lists of rules. They represent, we may say, how the principles of Buddhism are worked out in different spheres of human life and activity. Sometimes, in the course of lectures, we've considered 3 such spheres in particular, where Buddhist principles need to be worked out in a very practical manner. That is to say, the spheres of food, of work, and of marriage. First of all, a word or two about food. The Bodhisattva, according to the Mahayana Sutras, should eat, since even he has to eat, simply for the sake of health and energy or vigor, but not to satisfy neurotic cravings. And he should also eat harmlessly, without causing harm to other living beings, which means, in practice, being, as far as he possibly can, a vegetarian. Some people, when we come from philosophy to the subject of food, tend to smile a little. They think it's rather a come down from the sublime, as it were, to the ridiculous. And some scholars have been very surprised that in the Lankavatara Sutra, in the midst of very, very profound and abstruse metaphysical and epistemological speculations, you suddenly find a chapter on food, a chapter on meat eating. And of course the scholars say, aha, it must have been interpolated. The Buddha couldn't possibly have spoken upon a subject like this. Someone must have added it later on. But not so. This sort of attitude only goes to show people's want, in a way, of a sense of proportion, because the whole subject of food is much more important than we generally think. After all, we're eating food every day. Food has an effect upon our bodies and upon our minds. So it is much more important than we generally think. And we might even go so far as to say that it isn't much use our calling ourselves Buddhists or anything else of that nature and continuing in the same old way, so far as food is concerned, continuing maybe with our same old roast beef and 2 veg for dinner. One of the things that we have to appreciate when we take up Buddhism is that it isn't enough to study intellectually, to learn the philosophy. We have to start changing each and every aspect of our lives. And food, after all, is one of those really basic things. You can hardly have anything more basic than food, apart from air, perhaps. So certainly some change when one becomes a Buddhist or starts following the spiritual path or the path of evolution, higher evolution, some change, an important, a radical change, has to be made here. Then work. What about work? People often ask me about this, and I'm afraid my advice is short and simple and to the point. And I say, so far as work is concerned, do as little as possible. By work, of course, one means wage-earning work. Work simply for the sake of money, because you need money on which to live under the present economy. So work as little as possible, unless, of course, one's work is also one's true vocation. If that is the case, there need be no limitation whatever. But this sort of condition, one's work being one's vocation, is very rare under modern conditions. And in either case, whether it's work for the sake of money, wage slavery, or whether it is vocational work, the work should be in accordance with what we call perfect livelihood. It shouldn't harm, shouldn't exploit others, and it should not degrade or narrow or mechanicalize oneself. And of course, the spare time that one gains, if one does manage to work only part of the time, should be used for creative activities, for meditation, study, and the cultivation and development of real human relationships. And thirdly and lastly, marriage. Marriage, I'm afraid, is another of those dreadful words I'd prefer to avoid, because it raises all sorts of misconceptions in people's minds. Buddhist conception of marriage, we may say, as far as it has a conception at all, is entirely different from the Western Christian conception. To begin with, in Buddhism, marriage is not regarded as a religious sacrament. It's not regarded either as something legally binding and enforceable in a court of law. In a Buddhist context, we may say, marriage is primarily a human relationship, a relationship between two people, a relationship which is known to and accepted by the family, friends, and the social circle. And in Buddhist countries, we may say that there's never been any rigid or universal pattern of marriage relationship. In the Buddhist countries of the East, we find monogamy, we also find polygamy, and we also find polyandry. And these are all permitted and allowed. Now, the only criterion which is taken into consideration is the quality of the human relationship involved. And of course, I need hardly say that in all the Buddhist countries, under all these systems, divorce is permitted.